ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय.
Yesterday we completed text 36, where Brahma is glorifying the surrender process. The verse reads, "Therefore it's best for me to surrender unto his feet, which alone can deliver one from the miseries of repeated birth and death. Such surrender is all auspicious and allows one to perceive all happiness." And Prabhupada explains from many different angles that everybody has to surrender. They either surrender voluntarily or involuntarily. They either surrender to the Lord's lotus feet, or they surrender to the external energy, which is under the direction of the Supreme Lord. And back and forth, looking what those two positions are, the choice is really easy. But so many people don't take the easy choice, they take the difficult misfortune of surrendering to the material energy and therefore suffer. In the first three specific characteristics are describing the surrendering process: bhava chidam, svastayanam, and sumangalam. Bhava chidam. Chidam means cut, and bhava means bhava robe, the sufferings of material existence. So the surrendering process gives one, Prabhupada is using the word, liberty, freedom. Freedom from being bound up and captured by the material energy. And svasti ayanam. Ayanam means perceiving or seeing. Svasti, all happiness. Svasti ayanam and sumangalam, the source of everything auspicious or fortunate. These terms are very similar to the terms that are used by Rupa Goswami when he describes in the first chapter of Nectar of Devotion. There are six characteristics of pure devotional service. The first two are very similar to the first two here. Kleshagni, the termination of sufferings, and Shubha Da, the awakening of auspiciousness. So Sumangalam and Shubhada. And Bhava Chidam or Kleshagni, very similar terms. So that's the fruit or the byproduct of the surrendering process. That's what's described here. And in the Bhagavatam, it's the characteristics of pure devotional service. So it's a very important and also very pleasing understanding that these benefits, we don't have to wait until we're perfect souls. One can experience those things even in the practicing stage, in the sadhana bhakti stage. those six characteristics of pure devotional service, the first two of those six correspond with the sadhana bhakti stage of devotional service, practicing stage. And devotees, practicing devotees, experience the sufferings of material existence are cut off. They diminish. The term that I've been using during the weekend is this dimmer switch. The sufferings diminish, and the auspiciousness increases. So it's contact with the message of this verse from yesterday is contact with the personality of Godhead through the surrendering process brings one into that realm of where he resides, where there all there is good fortune and there is no suffering and boundless happiness that one cannot measure. We discussed this yesterday. Can the sky find its own limits? And the sky is just a part of Krishna. What to speak of finding the limits of Krishna? It's mind-boggling. You can't find the limits of Krishna. And so one who surrenders to Krishna's lotus feet finds the same qualities that are there with Krishna. This bhava chidam sumangalam and swasti ayanam. So he's disclosing, that's what I've decided to do. I've chosen to surrender to the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord for those reasons. And so the wisest person will similarly surrender to the lotus feet of Krishna. And the less wise or foolish person will keep their measuring sticks and where is Krishna? What's his limit? How do I know he exists? I can create a universe too. At least a small one. At least a Sputnik. Or whatever they call them. The Russian term. So, text 37. We'll cover 37 and 38 in both of these verses, just in advance. Overview. Very strongly Prabhupada desired that his devotees, that is, sincere souls in this world, not stay captured by the material scientists. Prabhupada disclosed in one confidential discussion with a number of his very faithful devotees, very intelligent devotees. Prabhupada disclosed that one of the most formidable obstacles to bring people of this world to the stage of pure devotion is their blind faith in this modern science. And the spokespersons for modern science and the methodology of modern science and the conclusions of modern science. For example, if modern science says something that seems to confirm or corroborate Vedic statements, oh, then that's good. Now we can put our faith in the Vedic statements because science says it's... We have such strong faith in this modern world. and strong. And why? It's the intellectual power base, ultimately. Science has given us so many nice things. Computers and cell phones and iPods and television and fast cars and spaceships to the moon and so many things, far out things. And before they didn't have those things, they just, you know, you went around in a bullock cart or rode a horse and then they got the horseless carriage and then birds fly in the sky, but now man can fly in the sky. And, you know, where's the limit? There's no limit. Just give us some time. We'll get you there. You've got a desire. We'll figure out how to fulfill desires because we're so smart. Yeah, something like that. So, what the scientist can't do, the scientist can do anything. And if the scientist says whatever they say, it must be so because it was scientific. Something that I very much appreciated from, let's go back in history. There was a time when Sariputta wrote an article in Bhaktivedanta about this. There was a time in European history when some European scholars started developing a fascination with the writings of the Vedas. So they started Max Weber and different European scholars started learning Sanskrit and finding, whoa, there's so much amazing information in the Sanskrit scriptures of ancient India. And, you know, there was kind of like like finding gold, and there was a gold rush. The intellectuals were going for the gold. Then there were some other intellectuals that thought this is really bad, because these intellectuals, the richness from our Christian scriptures is now being considered in a less important position than the Indian scriptures, the Sanskrit scriptures, the Vedic scriptures. And so I forget the name, Bartholomew or some really British sounding name, went on a campaign, a tour all over Europe. He and some other intellectuals got together and made this anti-Vedic scripture propaganda. And from it started the branch of knowledge called Indology, and which was a nice way of saying it's just mythology. And their theme went something like this. On the lecture tour, these gentlemen, were quoted as saying things like, "We will show in course of time that this mythology will be debunked completely by the empiric sciences of anthropology and cosmology." Anthropology means, you know, finding in the fossil record things that prove that humans didn't exist according to the dates given within the Vedas. It will prove by empiric science. Humbug. Rubbish. And the other was cosmology. As we become more and more sophisticated in our measurements through technology, we will show these numerical things that they show, that they present in Vishnu Purana and Mahabharata and Srimad Bhagavatam. Humbug. bogus, rubbish, just by empiric evidence. Well, lo and behold, it's just the other way around. But when the scientists find things that confirm their views and things, it's like one intellectual shoulder to shoulder with another intellectual shoulder to shoulder with another intellectual shoulder, and their integrity, their career, their reputation, and their money is all dependent upon, you know, the each guy saying, yeah, this is the way it is, and the other is rubbish. So they hold the intellectual foreground today. And the intellectual foreground of today is atheistic in the world of modern science. And so they want to eliminate, I mean, explicitly, not kind of innocently, many of the scientific intellectuals of today want to eliminate anything beyond their power base. So God has to be eliminated. And they're controlling the intellectual domain. Like all this argument about should intelligent design be taught in textbooks as a scientific theory, much like evolution is a scientific theory. There's all this tussle going on in the intellectual world, in the courtrooms of the United States over, is this a valid scientific theory? And and there's all this intellectual bashing going on. No, it's not scientific. So Sariputta did a very nice study, because he's a mathematician, of what the Vedas say about the cosmology of the universe and what the modern scientists say about the cosmology of the universe. And although one model, the scientific model, modern scientific model is sun-centered or heliocentric universe, at least solar system, the Vedic model is geocentric solar system. So one's got to be right and the other's got to be wrong, right? But it's not. The calculations show that it's practically a one-to-one correlation. The size of the planets, the periods of their orbit, and all numerical things. This Mr. whatever his name was in earlier European times was wrong. That the mathematical, the numerical merit of the Vedic picture without technology and with a geocentric picture has precise measurements. Now, you go back in time before the scientists had Hubble telescopes that they would mount on spacecraft that would fly around the universe and take many pictures and send them back, and the analysts would receive the pictures and make the measurements and get better and better, better measurements. They're just taking, for example, taking the distance between the Earth and the Sun and the size of the Sun. Those two things. Very simple astronomical calculations. Going back to Copernicus's time, they were off by something like a factor of 30. And then with the assistance of telescopes, it got better. It got about 20. And then when they had really good telescopes, it came about 10. And now, in other words, how much the numbers have changed over a period of time through the advancement of technology. So now, as technology is getting better and better, we got it. But the Vedic calculations, before there was technology, already had it. So how did they make those calculations? How do they know the size of the sun? How do they know the distances between the earth and the sun? How do you measure it? How did they do it? They did it by a different process, by the process of descending knowledge, not by sense perception or expanding the capacity of sense perception through technology. They did it through descending knowledge. So, here's the point. People have, in our modern times, people have such faith in science that if science says the sun is this big, that's how big it is. If the scientists say this is the distance between the earth and the sun, that's the distance. If the Vedas happen to say, hey, that makes the Vedas good, we can give some merit, some credibility to the Vedas. Because we have such faith, not in Shabda, we have such faith in modern science. There's so many examples. Out of body experiences, or evidences for belief in the soul or the reincarnation of the soul. This is that the soul exists apart from the body. Consciousness exists apart from the body. Because modern scientists would tell us that there is no such thing as consciousness. There is no such thing as a soul. What we call consciousness is, it's just a neurological, bio-neurological event of synapses at neuron endings firing and the signal being propagated along the cell. So there's a flow of ions, which are positive and negative, field that's created. And that's all that it is. That's what consciousness is. It's a biochemical event. There's no separate thing as a soul that's conscious. It's just, that's silly. But then there's so many evidences within science that indicate there is such a thing as the conscious self separate from the biochemical events of the body. Out-of-body experiences being one of them, and many things. So if science lines up with a theory, then we have more confidence in the theory, because we have confidence in science. So, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on. So Prabhupada saw that. Certainly it's in India, but it's so strong in the West. And hey, look what science has done for us. We have atomic bombs. We can blow up like a whole bunch of people all at once. Wars are fought, just go and invade this country, that country, use your technology and blast them out of the way, and you're in charge of the place. Look what technology can do for you. And so on. Communications and information and destruction and creation and medicine, and look what science has done for us. We believe in science. But behind the operative brain of at least the modern scientists is overt atheism. Because if everything happens by natural cause only and there's no controller behind it, hey, who needs God? And after all, that's just restriction anyways. You got God, then you got this guy that's going to say yes and no. I don't want somebody telling me yes and no. I want freedom. I'll just do it myself. I'll figure out how to do it and do things, get everything done the way I want it, through science. So, in these two purports, there's, and this section in general, Prabhupada does one of his favorite things, and that's letting his reader understand there's this false, blind faith in science. But what can they, to put the scientist in his place, Prabhupada is repeatedly looking at Lord Brahma, the most intelligent being. And the most intelligent being is drawing these conclusions. What about the scientist? Are we going to have more faith in Lord Brahma or faith in the scientist? Of course, you can meet a scientist. But how many persons have met scientists? And how many persons have met Lord Brahma? Probably about the same. Although these people are moving around and making their science conventions. Anyway, but someone might argue, who's met Brahma? Who even knows that Brahma exists? The knowledge, one who faithfully follows the path of spiritual life, can discern the existence of this transcendental knowledge that Brahma is providing. So here he goes, text 37. Since neither Lord Shiva nor you nor I, that's Lord Shiva, Narada, and Brahma. Lord Shiva, Narada, and Brahma. Since the three of us could not ascertain the limits of spiritual happiness, how can other demigods know it? And because all of us are bewildered by the illusory external energy of the Supreme Lord, we can see only this manifested cosmos according to our individual ability. Prabhupada goes into purport to the statement of the 12 great Mahajans. Dvadasha Mahajan, there's a in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, there's a discussion between Yamaraj and the Yamadutas after the Yamadutas are stopped by the Vishnu Dutas, and then they go whimpering over to Yamaraj saying, "What? Who are those people? We've never been stopped. Who can stop that? But we were stopped. What happened?" So in that section, Yamaraj describes there are 12 great authorities who understand perfectly well spiritual knowledge. And the first three are mentioned here in this verse. Svayambhu is Lord Brahma. Narada and Shambhu, Lord Shiva. Svayambhu, Narada, Shambhu, Komara, Kapila, Manu. Four Kumaras, Lord Kapila Dev, Svayambhu and Manu. That's six. Prahlada, Janaka, Bhishma, that's nine. Balir, Bali Maharaj. Vyasaki, Shukadeva Goswami. Vayam, and himself, Yamaraj. So those 12 great authorities, if something is not clearly understood, you go to one of them or a combination of them, and they will give the proper conclusion. So he's saying, all three of us, the proper conclusion is, we can't know the limits. That's the proper conclusion. We cannot know the limits. So then, of the Lord's potencies, the Lord's happiness, the happiness of the spiritual world, Brahma Sokhyam Tvanantam, we cannot know. So what to speak of the puny scientist in comparison? That the previous verse was saying, just as the sky cannot know its own limits, so what to speak of understanding the limits of God? But we don't know that limitation. We don't have the capacity to make those measurements. Therefore, the surrendering process is what we should do. And some comments that Prabhupada makes, just a little bit of it. Everyone thinks, in terms of his own capacity, that this universe which is manifested before us is all in all. And so, the scientist in the human society in the 20th century calculates the beginning and the end of the universe in his own way. But what can the scientist know? Even Brahma himself was once bewildered, thinking himself the only one Brahma favored by the Lord. But later on, by the grace of the Lord, he came to know that there are innumerable, more powerful Brahmas as well, and far bigger universes beyond this universe. And all of these universes combined together form Ekapadvibhuti, or one-fourth of the manifestation of the Lord's creative energy. So, do you know about this incident? Krishna was once paid a visit in Dwarka by Lord Brahma. Krishna called for Lord Brahma to come see him. Lord Brahma was very happy. Krishna wants to see me. Oh, how wonderful. So he came from Brahmaloka all the way to Dwarka. And when he came to Dwarka, Krishna was occupied. He saw the assistant and told him, Krishna has called for me, I've come. Please let him know that I've come. Said, just wait here a minute, I'll let him know that you've come. He went and informed Krishna that Brahma has come. Krishna said, please ask him which Brahma. And the messenger came back, the Lord wants to know which Brahma. Which Brahma? There's more than one Brahma? Well, please tell him it's the four-headed Brahma, the father of the Kumaras, has come to see him. So the messenger went to tell Krishna. He said, very well, inviting him. So when Brahma came by mystic power, he was able to see what the other Brahmas that also came at the same time were unable to see. The four-headed Brahma saw so many Brahmas also assembling. Ten-headed Brahma, 100-headed Brahma, 1,000-headed Brahma, 10,000-headed Brahma, because their universes are much bigger, so they somehow or other have more heads. And they all couldn't see one another, but simultaneously they tipped their many heads and placed their heads at the lotus feet of Krishna. Which is also mystical, because how big must Krishna's foot have been for them to touch their helmets to Krishna's foot? But by mystic power, Krishna enabled that to happen. And each of them were speaking. Brahma could hear. Each of them were speaking. Oh my Lord, thank you for inviting me to... just to demonstrate to Lord Brahma so he would not become falsely proud of his position of being the creator of the universe, he let him know that there are innumerable universes, much bigger than this universe. So he was just amazed. They paid their obeisances and left. And then Krishna said, "So, you've come to see me. What can I do for you?" "I just want to offer you my obeisances again and again, because now I understand, due to false pride, I was thinking I'm so important, I'm the creator of this universe. But I'm an insignificant speck before you." So if even Lord Brahma, who creates the entire universe, this smaller one that we're in, cannot know the extent of Krishna's potencies, and what to speak of a little guy like a scientist. And yet, persons of this world are very enamored by the words spoken by our scientific community today. And they're also bewildered by the illusory energy enough to think, "Yes, I'm so intelligent." When they should recognize their limitations. Unfortunately, due to the pride that goes with the territory of being a strong intellectual, they don't have that humility and sense of insignificance. So, Prabhupada goes on. The Lord says, "Mohitam nabijanati mab evya paramavyayam." Bewildered by the modes of material nature, they, people with tiny brains, they cannot understand that beyond these manifestations is a supreme person who is the absolute controller of everything. Brahma, Narada, and Shiva know all about the Lord to a considerable extent, and therefore one should follow the instructions of these great personalities. That's the upside. And the downside is, instead of being satisfied with a tiny brain and its playful discoveries such as spacecraft and similar products of science, Prabhupada wanted us to not have blind faith in modern science. When the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam was published, it created a buzz in ISKCON because it said many controversial things about the moon and about different things. So the devotees were trying to understand it and asking Prabhupada, "What does this mean? How do we understand this? And how do we understand that?" And Prabhupada disclosed, like I said, "I deliberately wrote things in this way because I wanted to pounce on this blind faith that people have in this Western world. Blind faith in science. They say blind faith in God. I say blind faith in science. Because the science says people believe it. Blind faith in science." And as the greatest, perhaps greatest obstacle for persons making advancement on a spiritual path, blind faith. It's not that Prabhupada wanted to dismiss science. He wanted to break the blind faith that whatever the scientist says is fact. At the same time, so in other words, Prabhupada was using the products of technology. He was using them to spread Krishna consciousness, flying in planes and using, you know, publishing equipment and printing presses and recording devices and broadcasting devices. And he was using the technology, but just for Krishna's service. But blind faith that through technology will make people deathless and impervious to disease, and just let us keep going, we'll figure it all out. will become immortal. And the controllers of all creation will become God. Or close to it. Blind faith. So, instead, Brahma's words are, let us offer our respectful obeisances unto that Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose incarnations and activities are chanted by us for glorification, though he can hardly be fully known as he is. So it's like the fifth verse in a row that this statement is made, this assertion is, one can know Krishna through devotion to some extent, to the extent that a tiny living entity can know something unlimited. We can know something. But if we don't use that approach of devotion, we'll know nothing. And we'll think we know so much. And this false pride and being covered by ignorance, it's a big problem. It binds one into a suffering condition. It's going back, it's the surrender to the material energy instead of surrender to Krishna. Tach chadadana munayo jnana vairagya yuktaya pashyantyatmani chatmanam bhaktya shruta grihitaya. Very nice verse from first canto Bhagavatam, where Sutta Goswami is teaching that the personality of Godhead is best approached by the process of hearing and chanting, hearing about him faithfully. And from that faithful hearing, the natural condition of knowledge of the soul awakens, the natural condition of detachment from illusory existence follows, and one finds happiness. Say the sumangalam bhavachidam. Swastyanam.
When you said Vedic model is geocentric, that means Earth is in the center.
It means the calculations are made from the Earth. I can do a little. The Vedic model, the Copernican model is, the sun is at the center of our solar system and the planets are moving around the sun. That's heliocentric. The geocentric model is, on its ecliptic, the sun is moving around the earth and the planets are moving around the sun. And so, as the sun moves around the earth, one can calculate the position of the planets as they move around the sun. So the distance between the earth and those planets is going to be the same, whether it's heliocentric or geocentric model. It's just a position from which you make the calculation. It's not literally saying, everything moves around me. But it's the calculation with the sun moving around the earth as it does and the planets moving around the sun.
Under this deeply conditioned tendency of which is born out of our academic education and of trying to figure out when you hear something in scripture, even I know that it's true, but still there's this tendency of trying to cut it down into steps or pieces and dissect it and dissect it and
it's a lot of years of hammering. So two things, faith and practice. You practice something else and you get another system down. And faith. So, to a certain degree, the faith is strengthened by reason. We're using the very method to strengthen our faith. But then, at a certain point, we have to let go of that faculty also, and just faith. In other words, if reason can't accomplish strengthening our faith, we abandon the reason component. On strength of faith. And then strength of faith comes from so many experiences, realization and purification.
Yeah.